Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Verbal Shenanigans Show. Hey, everybody. It's Scott again. Welcome back to another episode. A very fun one, but I want to tell you about some of the sponsors real quick before we begin. Waking up with back pain? 50% of Americans are. Sleep Ovation's new mattress is 700 tiny mattresses that individually cradle natural curves of your spine. This provides perfect comfort and spine support for the back pain and relief and the best damn sleep of your life. Right now, if you go over to sleepovation.com and pre-order your mattress and you use the show code VERBAL, you get $100 off. Good Christmas present for the girlfriend, nice new bed, 700 little cushions, taking her vertebrae and making them float like a cloud. Go check out my friends at Sleep Ovation, sleepovation.com. Now, we are lucky enough to have two brewery sponsors on this podcast. One of them happens to be Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. Demented has one of the coolest tap rooms, some of the best beer coming out of New Jersey. It's just a great place to go and grab a pint. Now, they just released Wrath, their Russian Imperial Stout. This Sunday, they're going to be releasing their all-new Wakatu Dry Hopped Lager. They're also going to be releasing bottles of Nightmare, their Belgian Strong Ale, aged in brandy barrels. So go give Demented some love. Go check them out. Go have a beer at the facility. Buy some swag. That is Demented Brewing. Now, Manskirt Brewing is also in New Jersey, located in Hackettstown. They're right on Main Street on the old bank building. It's a really cool place to go chill. A lot of room. Usually they have eight seasonally inspired ales, things rotating all the time. On December 23rd, they have a local band called Boy Things doing a reunion show at Manskirt Brewing. So go check them out. Go check out their holiday beers, their seasonal ales. That is Manskirt Brewing. If you've listened to the program before, you may have heard the name Susan Robb. She is one of our sponsors. They have launched with Kim Ward and Paul Templin and the Paul Outreach Program. It's a really good cause. Their goal is to reach $25,000 through different sponsorships. And in just a few weeks, they've already raised $5,000. They really need your help. But with that $5,000, they put 15 kids into school and supplied 17 ladies and moms with sewing supplies to start a business where they're trying to sell these really beautiful quilts. So far, they sell 10 of these quilts to 5 different countries around the world. So it's working. They just need some more help. Kim is the executive director of the Templar Foundation, a not-for-profit 501c3. And they want to secure a house for 15 women and to enroll 17 kids in school this year. The first $3,500 raised is going to go towards tuition for all these kids and sustain the sewing program the Templar Foundation helped them start in July. Kim and Susan are tirelessly appealing to their network and beyond for donations to keep this worthwhile initiative alive. Go check out the GoFundMe Nepal Outreach Program or donate through Twitter at Kim Marie Ward or at M Susan Robb, ROBB3. That is Susan Robb. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Trivia Revolution is a trivia company based out of New Jersey in all different breweries and craft beer bars. Each week, I host at Tap House 15 on Wednesday, but you could find a location pretty much all throughout New Jersey somewhere near you. You can be in last place, win prizes to breweries, and it's just a lot of fun. So go check out Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Now, today in the podcast, you may recognize him from Office Space as Samir, but he's been in a whole lot of other things, The Wrestler and Pie and a bunch of great movies. But we have the one and only Ajay Naidu coming on the podcast, and he was a lot of fun, really interesting guy, has a wealth of experience, and really just kind of does what he wants as far as in terms of acting. So go check out Ajay Naidu. Enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Ajay Naidu. You're listening to Verbal Shenanigans. Enjoy.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun. Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cool, right? Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
I think it's that time.
It's that time. Your weekly
Shenana
hour of
objection.
Well, actually, I don't know if we've had a show under an hour in like over a year.
I can't fathom one. Most of the time, we're screaming, "Oh crap! This is long."
Yeah, yeah. Especially when I'm editing it, and I'm like, "Oh, I still have another segment to add into it." Another, like, I think it was last week or the week before, I cut like a big chunk of what we were talking. I'm like, "This is too long." I just threw out something we were talking about. I mean, it wasn't good anyway. It was like I was talking about football or something.
Yeah,
something
yeah.
Nobody gives a shit about.
Well, Giant fan, Redskin fan, nobody gonna talk about us. So.
But man, I'll talk about the Giants for a second. Goodbye, McAdoo. Goodbye, Reese. I'm so brokenhearted over it.
I gotta be honest. I mean, the way it's all looking, it's making it look like the owners are like, we didn't appreciate what it did to Eli. But in the back, I know they're kind of like, yeah, we're thinking it's time. And also, they just looked at him as a fall guy. If they really were pissed off, they would have fired him before he did the whole benching thing.
I didn't understand the way it all went down. I thought if McAdoo was going to get fired, and like fire him, you know, him and Reese together. And I feel like the Eli thing was just, it just threw a big gasoline soaked log on an already negative fan base for this year. Like it was not going to do anything good. I get the idea of, you know, if they're going to start this Davis Webb kid and see what he has, then I can understand a little bit more. But if Geno Smith gets another start, like if it was just not like a week where the kid needs more time for the playbook and they're working him in, then I don't get it. Because Geno Smith's not the future, I hate to tell you. No, you guys could sign him if you want a franchise cousin.
Lord knows, I've been hearing rumors about Washington going after Manning. I'm like, oh, dear God, We've been through that with the McNabb experiment. No.
Is RG3 still around somewhere?
No, he got cut last year. The funny thing is, he's the last Cleveland quarterback to win a game. He was a starting quarterback for them when they beat the Chargers last year.
he might have been one of the biggest examples of fall from grace. Like, he looked like he was in the real deal the first 2 years. And yeah. Oh, my God.
No, 1 year. 1 year. Yeah. I mean, you're talking to the master of Redskins knowledge here. That first year, they built the whole offense around what he did at college, which was a smart idea. They did a very good draft. We picked up Alfred Morris that year in the seventh round, and it was a great combination where they were doing the option plays. I mean, Morris ain't the greatest running back. Of course, he destroyed Washington last Thursday. But he's the kind of guy, if he can get through that defensive line, that first layer, he can get kind of deadly. He can get past a linebacker and a cornerback. So that was a great combination because it's like, all right, I'm either giving up a huge running back who's going to demolish my backfield, or I got a sprinter who's going to go right by me and get like 60 yards.
Right.
And it was a great setup. And the injury started. Cousins even got a start in that rookie year, I remember. He played against Cleveland. And things were going well. And then at the Seattle game, had a lead, gave it up, struggling. Then the injury happened, and then the next year it was nothing. He didn't have his same talent. He wasn't accurately throwing, and that was my biggest thing. Like when I was watching it, like the biggest disappointment was in the third year when you're watching preseason. You're like, oh God, he is not what he used to be.
Yeah, I mean, to go from that high of a draft pick to playing a good season to being not in the league in like 4 years, that's an extreme swing.
He beat Jamarcus.
I mean, I don't know if that's your goal in life.
I think we both beat Jamarcus.
Well, Jamarcus is still probably sitting with, as long as he wasn't retarded, a couple mil sitting in the bank.
Well, he was kept on getting trouble. What was it? The codeine drinking? Like the
Purple Drank?
Purple Drank, yeah. The Jolly Ranchers, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, yeah. One day he'll be on the podcast. Don't worry.
We'll get him.
The guest we have tonight was on the pod, was one in our list from the original, and we put it aside for years, and literally years, and came back, and then I went and looked for him, and he's coming on tonight, hopefully. Well, in the next.
That's half the fun. Like our friends at Tecmo Madison, they contacted me about, hey, can you help us out? Figure out some stuff. We want to get some players that were like real big names in the Tecmo Bowl world. And I gave them some examples. And one of the things I said about the list was, you know, even after you make it, go back to it every like 6 months or whatever. And I gave our guest tonight as the example, and they're like, "Oh, dude, that's awesome!"
It was funny. Yesterday, I was watching. We were watching Elf,
mm-hmm.
and this is how programmed I am to like working on this podcast. I watch things. I go, this guy. Like, I should reach out to this person. Like, I can't like
Peter put it Dinklage.
It's funny. So
Will Ferrell.
No, I'm watching, and the scene with Peter Dinklage is on. I'm like, oh, we should get the midget from Elf. That would probably be an easy. Like,
that's how we introduce ourselves. We were watching this midget on Elf, and we'd say, you'd be perfect.
And I'm not putting two and two together. I'm like, he looks familiar, man. And I've watched Game of Thrones, like, you know, all the way through, and I'm sitting there like, he looks really familiar, but I can't remember what he's from. He's probably easy to. I got to look up his name when after that. And then, like, today, I forgot to do it last night. Today I'm like driving to work. I'm like, wait a minute, that's Peter Dinklage. That's like probably one of the hardest people to probably get on a podcast.
The only thing that would be more awesome is if you like went after him and just said we loved you in Elf and just kept talking about Elf.
Don't address.
And you actually got him.
Don't address Game of Thrones at else. All.
Dude, I love that episode of 30 Rock you were in. That was so great. Did you do anything after that?
Well, that's like how we've been getting those music guests through that guy, Ray B, that's been sending us a couple music guests. And one of the ones they represent is the guy who plays Hodor. I don't know if you watched Game of Thrones, but he was a big character for a while.
I understand. I don't watch, but I didn't know the reference.
It should be one of those that you definitely.
I'm sure it'll eventually come. I said the same thing about Sopranos. I think I saw the last episode. That's it.
Yeah. I think Game of Thrones is way better. But anyway, apparently he makes like EDM music and is like a big DJ in Europe and stuff too. And I'm like, oh, I would love to talk to him. And they're like, yeah, everybody would. But
just slip it in. And
so you never know. He might come up. Yeah. But are you getting in the Christmas spirit, Berlo?
The tree is up.
Tree's
up. Decorated.
Now, we got our tree yesterday also.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the whole, we did it last year too, the whole cut down the tree thing.
Okay.
Now, cutting down the tree is you know, it sounds awesome. But, you know, like, I don't know if you, because I guess when you go to like the lot, you know, most of the trees are nice trees, you know, like they're, mm-hmm. they're. Picked, you know, to go to a lot like
so. That. You're going to a place where a guy sells trees, and you cut down your own tree.
Right, they give you a saw, and you go down.
Yeah,
and cut
it.
No, you can only
sir, cut, bring it back.
You can only cut trees, bro. Not people. So you go and like it's like a tree farm basically, and it just says tree after tree. But the trees that are like at the farm are all there's a lot of like. Some are very barren at the bottom, misshapen. Mm-hmm. A lot look like bushes rather than like trees. And, you know, looking at a couple thousand trees and can't find one that you like after a while. It's like, all right, you know, like, but eventually you found a tree and you cut it down. And
like, how long was it to find the tree?
Like, I'd say about a half hour, 25 minutes, something like that. Anyway, which is fun, but it's not like this magic tree farm where all the good trees. And I feel like every year, the trees probably get a little uglier because mm-hmm. all the good ones are plucked out of the harvest and it takes a you know a good chunk of time to grow to a Christmas tree size tree.
Gotcha.
I don't know how they beautify the trees or if they do or the select ones get picked first, but
they bring in a makeup artist and we have to do something about your bangs.
Yeah. But a lot of the trees were you know big bushes, really big like they. But anyway. Mm. So we did that.
We call them 70s trees.
No more. Thank God that fad is gone. But then we did like a Christmas market. It's like a German Christmas market over in Sparta.
Okay.
And I had gone to it like 6 years ago, and it was pretty crowded and whatnot. And this time, and like parked, you couldn't even park, and it was just like everyone's on this like boardwalk with all these little stores and whatnot, and you are like shoulder to shoulder with people. Just I was like getting anxiety. I'm realizing that the older I get, the more and more I can't handle crowds.
No, I'm terrible like that. Like just going to like ShopRite and it's crowded, and all, I just get angst and all. And the worst feeling is. Like when you see something you want to go to, you take a couple steps and then somebody gets in the way. You got to do that half step, and Like, after a couple times, I'm just like, and they hear me, and it's like, yeah, I'm that guy. Get him away.
Yeah, I just don't like people enough. It's weird. I love crowds to tell jokes in front of, but mm-hmm. I hate crowds, like, anywhere else. I don't like crowded bars. I don't like crowded concerts even sometimes.
Maybe the next time you go to, like, the German Christmas town, you just get up and just start telling jokes.
That'll make people leave.
Yeah.
Quickly.
They'll either leave or you get standing ovation, you know. And you'll be a hero in the German community. And, you know, that's what we'll do the podcast from.
I am already a hero in the German community.
Really?
Yes.
Like, tell me some of your ancient stories of your heroism.
Well, you know, like the one time I ate the most knockwurst in a day.
Really?
The most knockwurst. Set the record.
Like, are we talking about time-wise, pound-wise?
No, just how much knockwurst I could fit into my mouth.
Okay. Right. So is it a contest, or you just walked in one day and said,
no,
that record's mine?
Yeah. I just walked into the local meat shop in Munich.
We all do.
Yeah. And I saw the various names, you know, how many inches they were able to eat. And
they go by inch instead of weight.
It's just inches. It's length. It's a length contest.
Is it one solid piece?
One gigantic piece of knockwurst.
Wow.
Yeah. And I beat the record by a solid 5 to 6. 5 to 6 inches, yeah.
Inches, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. College was a weird time. Was a weird time, and I learned a lot.
Like, how did you have, like, Randy Santel kind of training?
Nope, just college.
Just college?
Yep.
A little experimenting?
Yep, just, you
down
know.
Down in Germantown?
Just free, it was free times, you know, yeah. Free love. I mean, eating.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, you love to eat. That's what you're talking about.
So I set the knockwurst record, that's all.
Look at you.
Yeah.
Here I thought I was just here with a podcast buddy, but all along.
Knockwurst champion mm-hmm. in the world.
If I get a job in Munich, I'll be telling the tales of knowing the Brennan.
Well, speaking of jobs, like our guest our guest coming on is pretty iconic in a movie that really gained a cult following, and that is Office Space, which was one of my favorite movies for a long time. I loved it. Still love it. I haven't seen it in a while, but I loved it. So we have Ajay Naidu coming on, who, of course, plays Samir. Mm-hmm. It'd be weird if I was like, he plays Michael. But
Michael Bolton!
But I wanted to talk about, before we have it going on, I mean, that movie like basically symbolizes everyone's thoughts at some point in their life. Like, tired of going to work. I don't want to be in here. I want to just go do something else. And I'm just tired of like working for the man and doing all this, and hence him like cutting fish at his desk and not coming in to whenever you want. Everyone's thought about this at some point. Like, I just don't want to go in tomorrow. Like, I just don't feel like going in. I've had a lot of jobs. I was trying to think about the jobs that like I've really like slacked off on or like, you know, really didn't take seriously. Like, one of the ones that comes to my head, a couple of years ago, I needed extra money in the summer. Mm-hmm. So I did security at the lake that I lived in.
Okay.
And it was BS money. It was like straight cash, though. And I got to drive around in this truck, like this beat up truck, and then basically drive around the lake and just – but it would be
– Lake patrol.
Yeah. 100%. That's what it was. And
– It's huge in Germany when they found out Scott Brennan was starting in it.
Mm-hmm. So – The lake, basically my job was to drive around and open the gates and lock the gates at night to like the beaches. And it was just like a BS job. Everyone knew it was a BS job. Even the guy who hired me was like, it's pretty easy, you know, this is what you got to do. And it was boring, man. It was just by myself. So I would bring my laptop and I would bring like a DVD and watch a movie in there and just kind of move location every 15 minutes and park in a different parking lot. I would drive home and just like go sit at home for a half hour and then hop back in the car and jump back in. This was the best part of the job. I got to take out a remote control boat.
Okay.
And it was called the Goosinator.
Oh, nice.
And I had to chase geese off the lake for like an hour.
Now, is just that like a city Goosinator, or is it what happens here? Is this like the something that they give out to every lake security?
No, this was just, well, no, there was like one or two on the force, you know.
Okay.
So he showed me like how to go in the shed and start it and drive. And I spent
hey,
like,
can I put this out? Hey, rookie, small steps. This is whatever Lake Patrol.
Whatever you do, don't touch the goose.
And that's how the plot twist happens.
Help, I'm drowning. There's nobody that can go out there.
So I'm chasing geese for 20 minutes, just having a blast. That was pretty fun. But I do remember, so that job I really butchered, but I do remember one time on the job, they made me, there was a big heroin problem going on the beach, and they thought like a lot of high school kids were coming and like shooting up and leaving their needles and stuff on the beach, which is actually a legit problem in a lake community, you know. Mm-hmm. But they made me, he's like, I want you to kind of hide out in the playground, and then if someone comes, like, shine your light and try to get their information and call the police or whatnot. I'm like, really? All right. So I'm like,
are you in character?
You're yeah, like shaking. I'm kind of like, you know, getting, all right. So I'm like behind the jungle gym.
My name is Skippy. Yeah, Skippy.
So now like I'm behind the jungle gym, like kind of with a flashlight and like trying to blend in. But now like the mosquitoes are eating me. I'm like, this is awful.
Like patrol.
So I stay there for about a half hour and I'm like, this is stupid. You know, I'm texting, whatever. And all of a sudden I hear like rustle in the, you know, the people trying to come by the gate. And I'm like, oh crap, it's actual people. And sure enough, it was like a pack of like 3 14-year-olds, and I'm like, I don't know what do I do? Do I pop out and go, ooh, you know, like,
oh, I'll never do heroin again.
And sure enough, like, I kind of popped out with the flashlight. I was just like, hey, like, hey, get over here, or something like that. And they just like split and ran.
Old man Brennan.
Like, I could have like ran after them, but I'm like, then like right immediately in my head, I'm like, is this worth it? Like, I'm not gonna chase these kids. Like, if they chase him out of here, that's fine, but I'm not getting involved
in this. You see
this
frisbee on my leg? It's mine now. You see this? All right, 14-year-olds, I'm Lake Patrol.
But I was like, I'm not calling. I'm not putting my name on any of this paperwork or anything. I'm not doing any of this. So I chased him out with that. But that was a horrifically BS job.
Oh, my God.
That was awful.
So you're the reason why we still have an opium problem in the state. And yes, Chris Christie is still doing those commercials before he goes.
I love that he's talking about addiction to people as if he doesn't have a food addiction.
No.
You ever have a job that you just like, you know,
zoned out on? I guess the one I can think of was for a time I was doing weekends at Six Flags, and I was doing the parking
great
lot.
Great show, weekends at Six Flags.
I was doing the parking lot, so I was in a sailor suit.
What? So,
yeah, the uniform for the parking lot was a sailor suit.
or that's at least what your boss, quote unquote, told you.
Yeah, why is these chaps atlas?
No one else is wearing this.
Yeah. Go on, take my ticket, boy.
How come everyone signs into work in that office and you make me come to this one? There's nobody here.
Shut up. Let me park
there. Is this a locker room?
Me too. But it was kind of like side money and also to get like free tickets into the park. Like I was working close to 7 days a week at that point and going to college also. So it was one of those, they didn't really pay much, so I gave a living crap about it.
Yep.
There was so many times like somebody would come up and they'll have like the business tickets, you know, the company will give out a bunch of tickets with the stubs on the side for free parking. And I would I'd grab all the free parking stuff. They'll go, the next person come on, I'm like, don't worry. Don't worry. Don't worry. I didn't care. I was giving out, my brother had a business at the time. I was giving out his flyers with the Six Flags information. Because I was getting like a percentage if he got any jobs. I'm like, hell, why not? And it'll be more than $7 an hour.
There's something to say, like, there's something fun and like awful about those kind of jobs. Like, it's fun because like you're generally young and, you know, like, don't give a crap, and so you kind of goof off. I was also thinking about when I was I worked in the YMCAs and did lifeguarding and all that stuff for a long time, like many, many years. I was the assistant manager of a pool in the summer. And the pool, nobody came. It was like a couple old people came per day, and nobody. And we had a huge staff, like by the YMCA. So you would work like 15 minutes at every hour. Like lifeguarding, I recommend to all like high school kids and stuff like that. Like it's an easy job. It's, you know, there's plenty of places to work. But me and my buddy, we were like, we would go hang out in like the filter room, and like,
we would do that.
I bet you that's a package, a Christmas package. I got a dick in the box. I'm gonna let him bark that one out. All right, so sorry, the dog was was going crazy over my package delivery. I couldn't even work through his howling.
We return to the filter room.
I got my boat patrol lake patrol jacket in the mail.
So the YouTube project this summer.
But me and my buddy, he was the manager. I was assistant manager. He was probably like 21. I was 18, something like that. So we would come after hours and like come back to the pool. And like we were really into like freestyle rapping at the time, like for fun. Yeah. And we would bring like beers with us and like freestyle rap and like hang out at the pool, like the office, which is very bizarre to me now. But back then it seemed to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah.
This was back at the pool. I may have told the story a long time ago, but the same people came all the time. And there was this fat guy. He has to be dead now. He was the biggest piece of crap ever. He would come shirtless, orange, still lived with his parents. He was like 50-something years old. Like, his lips were like falling off from like tanning in the sun all day. Ew. And his name was Kenny. And Kenny, I hope you're listening, because you were gross. He would have like a...
He's in the basement somewhere. God damn it. Mom!
They're talking about me!
They brought the filter room again!
So he would bring like a big thermos of definitely booze. And but he was so fat and disgusting. He had sores on his – but he would come, like I said, barefoot with just a bathing suit on and like lay his towel out for the day and just oil himself. All that. Just oil, all day. Oil. Like basting a turkey. Like just oiling himself. So much so that when he got up at the end of the day, like, you know, packed up his blanket to go into his pickup truck, which was filled with newspapers, by the way.
That's worth good money.
We dare people to go like – we would dare
Breaking
people to
news
go
from
like,
ESPN.
We'd be like, go check out Kenny's truck. Go look in, see if there's anything crazy in there. And he would lift up his blanket and there'd be like an oil slick on the concrete. Big load of oil. He was definitely polluting the pool himself.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the locker rooms, the bathrooms were like the stalls are really, really, really small. And like I would have a hard time fit. Like they were just small. Like so we noticed one day while we were cleaning the bathrooms and whatnot that in the stall there was like a wet kind of mark on one side and a wet kind of mark on the other.
Mm-hmm.
We realized what it was. It was his oil from his body pressing on the walls on both sides when he was taking dumps in there. So he left oil imprints on
dump
the wall.
Grease.
Yeah, dump. Grease.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really hope he's living. And
he would just, like, quote, like, all these, like, 50s television shows all day and just, like, stare at the female lifeguard. He was a creep.
Oh, my God.
He's definitely on the Me Too list. Yeah. Sorry.
He's, like, 60-some years old. His parents were, like, 90, still taking care of him.
Then I remember waitering. I took it seriously, but I goofed off all the time. Like, I remember Sunday brunches. They didn't serve any alcohol from the bar until, like, 1 or whatever. So you had to make the mimosas. So we would just fill coffee cups up with champagne and, like, because it was so easy. Sunday brunch, you just basically served coffee and took plates away, you know, because they walked up. It was like a buffet. We'd do that, and I just remember pranking the Spanish chefs all the time and them, like, calling me gringo all the time and, like, messing up my orders on purpose. And we would do this thing where, like, if you were serving a table, like, a guy would come up to me, like, with a coat, like, whose coat is this? You told me you weren't cheating on me, like, right in front of people. And then, like, he'd storm off and then just be, like, have to, like... Like, so what would you like? You know, like, the whole goal was to try to get someone to crack or to laugh or, to make it awkward for everyone.
Yeah.
But it was so much fun, man.
Mm.
Waitering was like, and we had such an awful, like, owner / manager that, like, we kind of rallied around, like, how bad he was. And, like, we had fun with it. Like, it was kind of like, yeah, he's a giant piece of garbage. Like, but waitering, I was the only one of my friends who had money at the time. Like, I never have cash like that anymore.
Well, that's a funny thing. I've heard so many people, like, people knock waitering, but if you're in, like, a good restaurant, man, you will just come home with pockets full of money. And
my sister just stopped bartending. She did the same Sunday shift bartending for, like, 10 years, but she got a promotion at work, and she'd come home with $300-$400 cash per night.
Yeah.
You know, like nothing.
And a lot of people are hooking waiters and bartenders up where they're giving cash tips instead of putting on a credit card because obviously they can track it with the IRS. So they're like, oh, there's your tips. It's like, no, I didn't get any tips this night.
Yep, yep. So waitering is fun. What was your first job?
First job?
Well, then again, you weren't focusing very much at Quick Check.
Nah, was that my first job? No, that wasn't my first job. Yeah, that, I mean, that was a different type of goofing off there in the freezer.
Well, why don't you enlighten the new audience?
All right. Yeah, so for a while, I did. I worked for this company. We did like inventories for different companies. If you will. Our main client was Quick Check, but for the most part, yeah, it was Quick Check, and then we go to a few other like weird different thrift stores or whatever, but I met my girlfriend at the time at Quick Check. She was like the manager of the what we call the rig, and there'd be like three or four people that would go out for doing the inventories. So one time, like when we were really in dating, and there was only a couple people, they were out and we knew they were going to be out for a bit. We were kind of getting a little frisky, and we walked into a freezer of a Quick Check, and she kind of did some services onto me. We didn't do like a full on
right, but enough
till the end. But it, I guess it counts. And
now the freezer, like I can't imagine the freezer. There's lots of room in the freezer.
Oh, there's pretty decent sized room there. I mean, it's just boxes back there. So
you're like leaning against Ben and Jerry's containers, like just.
I think that's where they, they kept the ice and the ice cream.
Yeah. So they keep ice cream in the freezer. No way.
Yeah, they were innovative back then.
The cold, though, it's interesting that you could perform.
Well, we knew it wasn't going to be a full action, so it's just kind of like do a couple times just so we have a story and all. I'm the only one still telling the story. But yeah, it was like a fun change of pace.
She hasn't told anybody that story. You've told everybody.
I actually told her once. I did with the joke on stage. She's like, "Oh, you ass!" And all, but she laughed her rear end off about it. It's not like I say, "This is the girl, everybody."
Yeah. It's still pretty funny.
Yeah, that was good. That was kind of a like a goof off job. Like I took it serious, but like when we go to like certain stores, I'd realize the guy who owned the business and all, he was just a bullshit artist. He didn't care and all. Like, we would go into, like, we did a shop, right? A big grocery store, and they cut it off into sections. I'm trying to do everything right. I'm like, all right, there's 12 pineapple here, 11 guap, bananas, something like that. I see him walking around, and he's just, like, typing on it like a typewriter, and he's not even looking at it.
Damn.
And then I look at him walk around, and then he just... He makes up the numbers and then he inflates it, so that way it's like, oh, you have so much inventory and all, you can give us more. And
honest, every job around BS is a little bit. You got to find your ways, you know.
Yeah, I guess one story I can tell you. I'm not sure if I told it on the cast or not. I remember one time we had this one old man who used to go out with us, Joe, and he was famous. He had like a glass eye, and it was disgusting. He always had pus coming out of it. Where we'd just be
Joe and his pussy old eye.
Yeah, we'd have to pull him. It's like, Joe, clean that thing. I mean, he was kind of cool.
He
but
had one-legged uncles, pussy-eyed old Joe. They're all characters.
Hungarian Lou.
You guys got to go find those characters.
Sitcom.
we'll tell you about him again. Well, you might have to tell you about him again soon.
But we were doing inventory. It was like, I think it was like 2 weeks after 9/11. Now that's when I started doing the contracting work at C3I, and I was gone from the inventory job for a bit because I made more money over there. So I came back, and Joe, along with the pussy eye, on a side note, he also steals a lot. And also, like, a lot of time we'd just be outside and he's eating a can of sardines. I'm like, "Yo, Joe, where'd you get that?" "Oh, I brought it for lunch."
Wait. Take a step back. Slow down here. So Joe the pussy fake odd guy
would steal from the Quick Checks
and eat cans of sardines outside.
Yeah. Sorry, in the front.
I mean,
he
sounds like a class act. He sounds like a guy I'd hang out with.
I mean, he was kind of good fun, but he would do things that would piss us off. And one thing that basically happened was, like I said, this is like 2 weeks after 9/11, and we're outside and we're chit-chatting, and the manager of the Quick Check comes out, and you know, that's the general talk. Everybody's, when you first meet them, just after that scenario, it's like, oh, mm-hmm. where were you and all that. And I talked about, I was at C3I all night, you know, bringing back their phone system up. And then out of the blue, for God knows one reason, Joe's like, oh, I was so sad. And Mike lost his uncle in the 9/11. And he was going on about it. And it got to the point where I'm like, all right, if I say this is a joke, he's going to get fired. So I had to go with it. And I'm trying.
Wait, so you had to
yeah, so the
go
manager,
with the story.
The manager's like coming to me. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry. He's like hugging me. I'm like, yeah, we're
hold on 1 second. All right, sorry, continue. My dog once again interrupted the podcast. Mm-hmm. This never happened before.
No, never.
He was on the ledge of the lake ready to jump in. And those of you who are like, wow, you have a lake house. No. I rent a shoebox on the lake.
You get certain qualities when you join Lake Patrol.
Yeah. It was given to me. So wait. So you had to go with the story of your dead uncle.
Yeah.
Your dead fake uncle in 9/11.
Yeah, the backstory
was... this
has
bad karma all over it.
The backstory of it was there was, like, my former boss, his wife's best friend's fiance. He was actually on the top floor of the first building, and he perished through that. And there were some pictures they even looked at where they thought of one of the people that was jumping. They thought they saw a picture which kind of resembled him. I mean, he was a guy who used to do jump out of airplanes, parachuting, and stuff like that. So they were like,
his form is perfect?
No. It's, wow. It was just... I don't know how to continue from that. No, but they were saying that would be something he would do because it was like the picture was showing the guy from the top kind of like jumping out. So,
right.
But in any case, so like,
I recognize that swan dive anywhere.
So I am. I tell the story to the crew and all, Lisa, who I was dating at the time, and Joe. And then Joe just, like, in front of this manager, turns it into the guy who died was my uncle. So, like, the manager's coming to me. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry. He's putting his hand on my, you know, shoulder. I'm like, yeah, the family's trying to get through it. And it's a little rough. I'm trying to embellish. I didn't know him that well, so he didn't, like, wonder why I'm not, like, tearing up or anything like that. But, you know, we're... trying to get
the best is
it.
That you have to lie, but you have to lie also the other way, so to the reason of why you're not that sad. You have to pet up. You know, he wasn't that great of a guy.
He wasn't that great of a guy. He was kind of an asshole, to be honest. But that's the kind of honest truth, bud. So I get through it, and the manager walks away, and I swear, I slug him as hard as I can in the damn arm. I'm like, oh, what the hell? And then he just starts cackling and all that, and he pulls out a can of sardines and starts eating in front of me.
He's like a super villain.
Penguin!
Wait, now when you punch him, does his eye, like, can you punch him hard enough for his eye to shoot out?
No, his eye, he had Cole out to work a couple times because he lost his glass eye because he was also a drunk.
Well, let's be honest, you got a pussy eye, pussy fake eye, you're probably a drunk.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons to drink. Mm. Wow.
So, That's One-Eyed Joe.
One-Eyed Joe. One day we gotta go through just like a segment
One
of characters.
One-Eyed Joe!
Just a segment of like characters. Like, I had Oily Kenny.
Oily Kenny, One-Eyed Joe, Hungarian Louie.
One day we'll just have like a character segment where we talk about some of the characters again, especially for like people who are listening now. Mm-hmm. Some of the classic characters that your uncle.
Oh, yeah. One-legged gay uncle.
Yep. My first job was the Great Train Store. I sold model trains.
Really?
I got paid $5.75 an hour, so it's kind of a big deal.
Oh, look at you.
525 was minimum wage, so I was crushing. And I wanted a job, and this girl I had a crush on was working there, and she's like, I can get you a job. I'm like, let's go. Let's sell trains. And I swear to God, I sold like Lionel trains and Thomas the Tank Engine trains, and it was actually a pretty good job for a kid. It was right in the mall, and I don't know. But
how's the train market now? I don't know, man.
I feel like it's probably all online.
Yeah.
But it was like a train store in the mall. Like the train went around, like the store, and like outside the store. Kind of like an old school store. I wish that they still had those kind of, not like all chains.
I guess to answer your question, if not counting my dad getting me a summer job at his can company, it was the pet vaccination. Love my pet.
My dad was just telling me that we were kind of having a similar conversation. I was talking about some of his jobs, and he's like, you know, I worked so many jobs. I'm like, because I was talking about how many I've had a million little side gigs. And he was saying when he was like 14, 15, he went and worked at a chicken coop, like a chicken slaughtery. And he was like, I lasted like 2 days. They made me put like chickens on pallets, like ready to get killed, and like strap them down. I'm like, strap them down. And I don't know. He sounded like a World War, like he wasn't telling me all the details. He was like, it was awful. Like, and I could never do that. So.
Every night I got smacked in the back of the head by William Perdue. He was so
Work faster.
I want to kill more chickens, he said.
These chickens must die.
My grandpa died by a chicken. I'm getting my revenge.
And he said that, and he said he also worked at like a vet. He helped out at a vet, and he said he couldn't deal with it. He was like putting down animals was too hard.
Yeah. That's the reason why I couldn't get into pet stuff. Like, I love animals to death, but Lord, I mean, I've only had to hold on to one animal as it went down, and it was not a fun feeling.
I can't even imagine. God bless the people that do it, but it's not for me. I think that we should segue into our guest here.
Absolutely.
So once again, from Office Space, and many, many other things, which hopefully we'll bring up a few of these during our interview, the one and only Ajay Naidu.
Hello.
Hey, is this Ajay?
Yeah, it's Ajay. How are you?
Ajay, we are great. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes here. This is Scott, and this is my buddy Mike Berlow here.
Evening, Ajay.
How are you guys? Great to speak to you.
We are great. Where are we calling you at? Where are you at?
We're in New York. I'm in New York.
Oh, okay. All right. So we're right in Jersey, so we're not far at all. But Ajay, once again, thanks for giving us a few minutes. We were just talking, like, it's funny, before you came on, we were just talking about how, you know, the movie Office Space in general, just, I think, I'd like to get your take on it, but I think the reason it became such a phenomenon is because it's so absolutely relatable. Like, everyone has felt that ridiculousness of a day-to-day job they don't want to go to, and some of the characters that go along with it, and the BS that you get angry about that no one else really understands in the outside world. When you were going into that role, did you come from different kind of jobs like that, or were you always working in acting?
Oh, I've always been an actor, but the truth is, at that time, all my friends, everyone I knew, most of the young people coming into the workforce were getting ready to face, like, you know, the most dehumanizing, stuff of all time. It's during the time of the initial tech boom, when the drones were, that's what you expected when you got out of college, is that if you were lucky, you were going to get into one of these situations and have this happen to you. And so there was a lot of kids going through that. And, you know, there was also the coolification of the nerd was happening at the same time. So, like, you know, I think, you know, having to deal with these things and remain a vulnerable sort of, normal person, it kind of almost became impossible for a while for young people coming up in the workforce. And I think that the reason it kind of built, you know, an underground wave and then a big tumultuous sort of cult following is because these people were going through some really, really painful, dehumanizing things in the workplace, and like you said, it was deeply relatable, you know. So I think that's why, and it was that particular moment. I mean, even though the movie was pulled from the theaters and the studio didn't even like the movie at the time, they liked it once it made a lot of money for them. But
of
they,
course, it, it, now they
but,
love
you know,
it.
You know, but at the time they didn't like us at all. They didn't want the movie out. They didn't. They pulled it from the theaters, but as a result of what was actually happening, you know, Mike Judge is extremely smart, deeply tuned into the zeitgeist and you know, the way things are going, and he made a movie accordingly, and it blew up as a result, you know, as a result of his deep intuition and his, you know, his perspective. So that's why I think it blew up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, we'll get into a little bit more, but let's talk about your whole acting career going up into it. Like, I'm looking over your resume, and it's just amazing. Like, one of your first acting gigs is playing a 12-year-old with a terminal illness in an after-school special. Mm-hmm. Is that just something where you sit back and you, like, kind of craved it? Or is it one of those when you're 12 years old, like, hey, I just want to do a scene where I have like an imaginary friend or something like that. Let's start.
No. It wasn't like that at all. I mean, I started my career very young as a result of like one of my school teacher, whose son was a deeply prolific actor called Adam Baldwin, and I was, you know, I came up in my very first films in this what was like the Chicago film renaissance of the 80s, and they were making a lot of really important, I guess, you know, middle American, you know, social dramas in and around that world. And so I was not one of these. It wasn't like a lark for me. I didn't start acting because that was something I wanted to do. It was something that happened. So it can't, you know, she took me to an open call after school one day, and I got the lead in this Michael Keaton picture after like, you know, 50 callbacks, you know? So it was like, it was all very fortuitous and kind of, I got jumped into the business. And then when I was around 14, I left that because it was kind of disillusioned with it. And I went back to school, and it was only a matter of a few minutes in school before I saw classical theater and realized why I was in it from the beginning. Because before I had acted in any pictures, I was wandering around talking Shakespeare to myself because my sister was in high school reading me Shakespeare all the time. So I was obsessed with that. And so by the time I was 16, I decided I wanted to be a classical actor, and I started training as hard as I could for it. By the time I got out of college, out of high school, I knew I wanted to go to conservatory, but you know, I didn't get into Juilliard. I got called back for Royal Academy. I didn't know what to do, and I had already been working as an actor. So I worked for some time in Chicago, and I went to a sort of a trade school for the arts called Columbia College. And then I ended up auditioning and getting into – well, I started working in theater in Chicago, and then I ended up auditioning and getting into Harvard at ART. And then the first movie I did coming out of there was a play I was supposed to do called Suburbia that Rick Linklater directed. And because I got – Independent Spirit nomination for the role, it kicked off a whole slew of new things and sort of started my film career. So that's how it all unfolded for me. So none of it was really a lark or just something I wanted to do. Everything I've ever done has been as a result of I'm supposed to do it. Right. So
now let's talk about your upbringing a little bit. Like, were your parents completely supportive of your acting choice? Were they driving your choice in acting, or was this something?
It was completely up to me. My parents supported me. They thought I should do something that I really loved. They're very I didn't have any cultural issues about anything. You know, I mean, it wasn't one of those things where like, you know, you're gonna be a doctor and all that stuff. My brother kind of paved the way for me and became like the perfect guy. I was able to enjoy what was coming my way. So I became an actor before anyone could even say anything, paid my way through college. So what, you know, and helped my family out at a time when they really needed it. So, awesome. You know, it was one of those things that just, I was kind of meant to do it, and I'm a lifer. So, you know what I mean? It's not something I'm going to quit. It's something I'm going to stay with forever. So
yeah, let's talk about that. Just you saying you're a lifer, like, obviously, people know you mostly from the character Samir, which I want to get into in a minute. But you look at your resume, And you have things from The Sopranos to Requiem for a Dream to Pi to all these different characters on so many different things. Like, your filmography on IMDb just seems to go on forever.
I'm honored that you would say it.
But, I mean, it's just a lot of things that we have all watched in our everyday lives or you know, a couple movies that have a cult following, The Wrestler, Pi, like I said, Requiem for a Dream. You have a lot of different roles, whether it's like larger roles or just all sorts of minor roles in movies. Do you do those things? Are you one of the guys that just kind of takes like any opportunity that comes, or are you always just kind of working to find what's like either next big thing, or like, are you, what kind of acting are you looking for?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no, I was just talking for like a good while. I'm sorry. So
hope you said that.
But I was just saying that the variety in my career has been largely due to whatever I'm interested in at the time, and that whatever I'm working on at the time is usually my favorite thing. I've never really been in anything that I didn't really like. Love or mm-hmm. have a reason to be in. I never get parts that in sucky things, but I mean, it would really help though. I mean, for money and for career. I mean, it would be great to just be in everything, you know. But you can't. So I have to. Whenever I focus my energies or my intentions on various stories, because that's what I do. I tell stories by any means necessary, and this is how these things come my way. I just kind of invite them. I kind of invite them in. Darren, for instance, you were talking about, you know, you mentioned three of his movies. Darren, I helped Darren to make Pi when he was just, you know, a street filmmaker, you know what I mean, and asking all of his friends for $100 to make the movie, and we just talked about acting, you know. And at that time, Darren was very open to everything, and you know, he kind of made a little ensemble that, you know, has played through his movies and stuff like that. Now he has since changed drastically, because you know he's in charge of many, many millions and millions upon millions of dollars, so he doesn't always get to make the decisions that he would want to make, you know what I mean. But he at that time he was uproariously creative, and yes. and I responded to that, and I usually respond. Most of the filmmakers and directors that I get hired by are extremely cool people. So
I was going to say, it can't be coincidence that you're in movies that all these things have cult following. Yeah. All the ones I just named, people still watch today on a regular basis and talk about.
Even TV series, West Wing, King of the Hill. You can't even bring up Bad Santa, which is also a good cult hit.
Yeah. I love that movie. Actually, I was so glad. I was so glad that movie happened. I love that movie.
That was.
I think. You know, there's a particular style of acting in Americana that, you know, I've always admired, and you know, and that I've always aspired to, and it's a little realer than real, you know what I mean? It's a kind of an inhabiting of a character as opposed to like kind of playing a character, you know, and there is a science to it, because it's not an outward portrayal. It's an inward journey. So most of the stuff that I get hired for are from these dudes who are doing these kind of like really kind of subtle and beautiful things. And I'm always like, boy, man, I'm just a nuts and bolts kind of carpenter actor. And like, I, you know, I always come in there banging, bang, tong, bang. And like, you know, it they're like, whoa, you know, we see where you're going. You just have to not show too much. So my journey has always been with these sophisticated directors to try and just, you know, pull back and think the thoughts, as opposed to like playing parts, you know what I mean? I think that because I have that in my hip pocket as a modus operandi, the directors that see it, we tend to connect for life. So it's like that. It's that, that's the only thing I can put down to do it. But I don't always work. So it's kind of, I mean, like, I mean, I work in theater continuously over, you know, since I was a kid, but I, you know, it's really strange. Sometimes the America isn't ready to kind of digest whatever story I'm really trying to tell or be in or be alongside. So I can't put anything down to the fact that everything is, that I'm in a lot of cult movies, but maybe it's just the fact that these dudes are all kind of, I share an aesthetic with a lot of them.
Or you just pick, you got to have an idea of what you're picking. I mean, there's got to be something to it. Like, it doesn't happen by coincidence, I don't think.
Well, there was a time when I was picky. It didn't do me any good. It didn't do me any service.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I just like really have a look at stuff, you know, and if it's that cheesy, I probably shouldn't be there because I'm going to get in trouble for talking about it. You know what I mean? So like, I mean, I always take that into consideration. I mean, everything I've ever done, I mean, I've been fired from stuff where I got there and I was like, I can't, I don't know how.
Right.
You know what I mean? And, they've been like, well, what do you mean? You know, we offered you this part. You don't, and I was like, I know. Damn. You know what I mean? Like,
I know.
Yes.
Exactly. I just,
sucks
I just
for you.
You really, I know the guy you want and I'm not him. You know what I mean? So like, this has happened to me before, but on the other hand, like most of the stuff coming down the pike, I'm like, oh man, how exciting. Of course I want to do the movie. You know what I mean? Or of course I want to do the show, you know? So it's like, I mean, some of them I've really had to fight for. Some of them I haven't. I've rarely booked apart from an audition though. I can tell you that rarely, you know, it's always coming down the pike from left field. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. With all your, acting, like one thing I did see, you also did some directing and writing for the movie Ashes. What was so special about that project, and why did you tackle so much for it?
Well, it was a deeply personal project, and it was just a kind of a logical progression for me at the time. I was deeply involved with the Asian underground movement, Indian electronica, and the rave movement. And simultaneously, there was this story I had been writing about where I grew up and about my sister who died when I was pretty young. She was manic depressive schizoid disorder, and she committed suicide. And I didn't know how I was going to tell that story. But it took me about like 10 years to kind of with the music as the kind of backdrop for it, it kind of just kind of fell out of the story kind of fell out of me. And then I, you know, like every typical first time director, I just like rewrote it 1,000 times and had worked on it with a lot of people. And, you know, by the time I got to making it, you know, I still hadn't raised any money for it, and it was going forward at a rate where I couldn't stop. So I just ended up making it for, and, you know, taking a hit and paying it back by doing theater over 4 years. So like I did it as a purely passion project, but I by the time I was done, I was like, man, fuck passion projects. You know? don't ever, you know, if someone asks me like, oh, yo, should I make a movie? I'm like, don't do it. You know what I mean? Don't. But on the other hand, I'm like, yeah, man, if someone's going to give you the money, you know, you could pay $50,000 to go to film school and have people to tell you to not spend your own money on making movies,
mm-hmm.
or you could spend $50,000 and end up with your first movie. So I took the second route, which was hard and horrible, but the movie is beautiful and terrible, and, you know, so what am I gonna do? I mean, like, it was just a thing that happened, and I had to see it all the way through. But boy, I was held hostage to it for a really long time, and in looking back, I would never do anything the same. So
yeah, you tried it though. You threw it against the wall and tried it. All right, let's talk about the character of Samir and when that when that movie was being in pre-production and whatnot, and how did you get contacted for that, and what did you do to kind of get into that character?
Yeah. So I was in California at the time, and I remember like I was being seen for really great things. And I mean, I got sent this script, and I was out at my friend and I were in a shack in Malibu. I remember, like, we were like renting a place out there, and like, you know, we'd drive into town and go to meetings and stuff like that. And I remember getting this, and my agent at the time was like, let me tell you something, man. This is – everyone wants this. Everyone wants this part, this movie. And I'm like, oh, really? And I was like, wow, it's that's cool. I mean, the part is cool. He's Middle Eastern, which is at that time I was a big break, different from being an Indian dude. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, he's wildly different to anything. You know what I mean? And like I read it, and he had like all of his amazing things that he does, and it was right on the page. And I was like, wow, well, this is a great guy. This is an amazing, amazing dude, you know what I mean? As a, he's kind of, none of like the breakdancing or any of that improv stuff was in there, but like there was a lot to suggest that he was not like a nerd.
Yep.
You know what I mean? So I was like, I really like it, you know. He's like really put upon, you know what I mean? But he's not this dude, you know. He's not like a nerd. So like I liked it. My friend took me as I was going to the audition. I was like trying Middle Eastern, which is wildly different to South Asian, you know, and my friend was like, I think you need to scuzz it up a little. You know what I mean? And I was like, maybe, but like, you know, he's kind of good. He's like, nah, man, give him some dirt. You know what I mean? And I was like, yeah, maybe. So like, I went to the initial meeting, like it was in this like really beautiful little Hollywood bungalow style casting. And Mike Judge wasn't there. It was just like, you know, the cool casting, Nancy Clopper, you know, she was there. And like outside auditioning for and I know that they were auditioning for Ron's part was like James Spader. And like a bunch of like, you know, like a lot of heads, you know, were there, like hot shit dudes were there. And I was like, oh shit, this is going to be like, this is a real movie. You know what I mean? So then I had my meeting and stuff like that, and it went great. And then I didn't hear anything for a while. And then when I flew back to New York sometime later, and I got this call from my agent. They're like, Mike Judge, the director of that movie, he wants to meet you. He's so great. I'm like, yeah, cool. So I went to Four Seasons and met Mike, and he was like, so, I think you're really cool. You know, I was like, oh, thank you. You know, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, so this Middle Eastern thing, I mean, do you think you got that? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, would you want a coach to learn the accent? I was like, you know what? That's a great idea. Like, let's make it really specific. If I did it, I would want it to be really specific. And he's like, all right. Okay, cool. And then I was like, yeah. So we did. So and then I booked it. And then all of a sudden I was training with a dialect coach in a very specific Jordanian accent. You know what I mean? And that gave to me a kind of like, sort of really front foot. Gave that character like a front foot power that like it's different to like doing like an Indian guy or something like that. You know, he's a very he's different to most people. You know what I mean? And like I just like ate it up. But when we got there, I mean, it you know the studio was started yelling at everybody early on in the movie like, you guys are ugly, you're not funny, you know, Ron Livingston should lose weight. Like there was a lot of stuff, you know, they just kept on coming with it, and they were like, and this guy, he's bald, you know, and like about me, and like, and just like a lot of stuff. So it was like, everyone was like, you know, by the time we were in our second week, it was kind of like, let's just have fun,
because
they're going to kill us. You know what I mean? So like but as a result, man, all this amazing stuff happened, like these great shots. And like, we just started having fun and improvising. And at the time I was down in Austin breakdancing. I mean, we were in Austin, but there's this amazing Indian breakdance crew down there. And I was going out every night breaking. So like, I was like dancing every night with my friends. So it just wasn't like logical that I would dance in the movie. And, you know, with the printer stuff and all that kind of stuff, like one time after the movie had come out and all this, I was standing out front of this casting office, and across the way was this cigar shop. And there was all these like deep, spurious, big, like, I don't want to like say it, but they were like fully mafioso like type dudes like hanging around the front of it. And this big scary dude was like, yo, hey, you. And I was like, oh shit. And he's like, come here. I said, I went across the street. He's like, come in here. And I was like, oh shit. Like, what's going on? You know what I mean? And like, I went in and they were like, oh shit. Oh shit, man, we're your biggest fans, da da da. They're like, we just want you to know. And the guy's like, wait, shut up, everyone, shut up. We just want you to know, we thought the way you did the printer was very authentic.
Wow, authentic.
Yeah. They're like, so have a cigar. Like, and I was all right. Like, I gave me like a cigar, like half the size of my body. And I was like, just like in there for a minute. I had to go up to a casting a few minutes later. And like, I was like, well, I'm going up for this movie. They're like, what's the movie? And I was like, well, you know, it's not a big deal. Like, maybe we know somebody on it. What do you want? You know, I was like, no, I am fine. Like, no, you guys don't know anybody on it. You know what I mean? And they're like, no, maybe we do. Try me out. And I was like, oh, well. I knew that it was kind of a big movie when, like, the mob was down. You know, so it's like.
Well, it's always good to have the mob as one of your best friends.
Like, it was one thing to have, like, a bunch of, like, old, like, executive dudes at the ski lifts yelling at you. But it's another thing when the mob talks to you. So it's cool.
Now, when it sounded like you guys decided to have fun with it and it came out.
It definitely came across to you. Like,
I mean.
Well, I'm glad, you know. I mean, it has been a beautiful. I mean, like, it's good to have one like that in your life, you know what I mean? It's just done so much for me, and you know.
Now, let me ask you, when it came out to the box office and it kind of bombed at the box office, did you guys just sit back and go, oh, that sucks, you know, it's all over? Or was there any inkling, okay, this will come back?
Oh, no, I had no inkling it was coming back, and I thought it was over at the first screening I ever saw of it, because there was, like, six people there, and, like, my agents were like, it was really funny. I don't know what happened. And I was like, yeah, me neither. Okay, bye. You know what I mean? Like, they're like, oh, well. You know, and I was like, yeah, oh, well. You know what I mean? And then, like, little by little, it just kind of built, and, like, I knew that it was growing because people were – stopping me, you know what I mean? And I was like, but you know, it's kind of a really tongue-in-cheek, everyone that ever talks to me about it on such a personal level, you know what I mean? They're like, oh man, I really felt, I was like, you did, you know what I mean? Because I mean, I think it's funny and wonderful, and I thought it's a great movie, but I didn't know. I mean, like, these people really, really had some kind of, you know, deep personal thing, because they're in the workspace. So it's, you know, they're dealing with it daily, and it's real.
There's still people that quote things all the time. The copier scene comes up all the time.
Jump to conclusions.
Yes.
I think it's just so real because we've all been through such garbage, you know, before, like, things that were like, oh,
no, we've all taken it, man. We've all had our Lumbergs, you know what I mean, and our Bobs, you know. It's like, it doesn't matter whether or not it's in the movies or in the you know, wherever you are, you've got a lump. There's a Lumberg, you know what I mean? Someone with a big nose who knows, you know what I mean? So
Can you believe that movie's coming up on 20 years old?
Oh my God, man! Don't even remind me. It's like, I mean, I'm happy, but I'm like, jeez, wow.
20 years.
My God, no, you're kidding me. Oh, I was partying so hard back then. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So,
no, I wanted to ask you, as an Indian man, a man who grew up. This is a common, like, topic you hear, like, especially in Hollywood and whatnot. What do you feel like? Do you find yourself getting, like, typecasted into, like, hey, play the Indian guy, the sidekick, or whatever it is?
Look, one of my best friends just made a movie about this. Okay, his movie's called The Problem with Upward.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's my dear, dear friend, and I'm interviewed in the movie as well. So, I mean, like, look, I could talk to you for an hour about it, but the long and short to me is I came up in a different time than these kids now, where they can, like, make a career on talking shit about how they have to play Indian parts.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, I had to do what I had to do no matter what, and I was taught – coming up that, like, man, you take a part, and if you are the one that they want to have play it, it's your responsibility to discuss with the creatives and the director about dignity, you know, or whether or not this character is dignified, and run the risk of being fired.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you decide to fight that fight, you open up, you take the heat for what you do. You know what I mean? So if you come out and you're like, you know, people are like, oh man, that's racist. You know what I mean? Like, you'd be like, oh, well, maybe you can't put it always on the people that are making it.
Right.
You have to also put it in the portrayal too, and how, you know, what you're doing. You know what I mean? So I believe the onus of racism you know, I mean, look, it's rampant. Hollywood's been doing this forever. I mean, like, you know, it's you think it's part of the grain, but I think it's right to fight. You know what I mean? Especially when you can see it overtly and they think you're on their team when they're fucking you up. You know what I mean? I'm not sorry, not to swear.
No, it doesn't matter.
I mean, like, you know, so I mean, I have faced it before, but I never got cast because they sensed that I didn't like them. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or that I thought that they were being racist. And then they were like, we're not. And I'm like, okay, that's up to you, but you are. Right. You know what I mean? And so, you know, I do believe that that there was a time and that time is past, but I, in a certain way, but I do also think that the ingrained racism and the sort of, you know, oh, well, this is meant to be a Indian guy, or this is meant to be a, you know, that people make up their minds about what that is. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, some people I go in there like, you're not an Indian dude. You're not an Indian guy. And I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? Right. You know, of course I am. I'm just not a dude who's like 5'8" with glasses, who's a nerd. I mean, are you, you know, what type of emasculation are you looking for when you say these things? Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
That's how I look at it. And if it's legit and they've made an honest to God racist mistake, because I mean, God knows everyone makes racist mistakes. You know, because of whoever their upbringing. I don't care how PC you are. You know what I mean?
Right.
We all put our foot in our mouths here and there, especially when we're trying to be vulnerable and creative and tell a real story. But my argument is, man, I came up as a trailblazer. You know what I mean? I don't mean to like toot my own horn, but like I made all my own opportunities and I feel proud because the young people in my community have been really, really good to me so far. At least the ones from America have. You know, I feel grateful that I was able to come up in a time where I was kind of like a anomaly, because it helped me. It helped me to be seen as a viable human being in the fabric of the country. You know what I'm saying? So right. that's my take on it. But is it there? Yes. Have I been subjected to it? Absolutely. Have I fought and been fired for it? Yes. Has it been a hard fight for all the people coming up from the Indo-American community in Hollywood? I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it's been. Everyone has a different journey, but I think everyone has faced different aspects of racism.
Good answer. It's well thought out.
Now, along with all your acting, I've seen you brought up your break dancing. You've done MC work. You were part of a musical group. Do you look at that as like a side hobby? Is that like an addition to the arts in your world? Oh. No. I'm going to complete this question. Hope he doesn't live in Canada.
Yeah.
You said New York.
$5.99 the first minute.
A few minutes.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. I don't know where I fell out, but it.
Yeah, whatever, man. No.
whoa, now you guys are real. Now it sounds real jittery. Are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
We're here.
Oh,
here.
Okay.
You good?
Okay. Yeah. Not really. It's going like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like that. Hang on. Yeah, when you just went, it went.
That was so, just my evil laugh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, there you are. There, that's much clearer.
Everything's good?
Yeah.
All right.
As I was asking, I mean, you brought up your break dancing, you've done MC work, you're part of a musical group. Do you look at that as like a hobby, as an extension of your arts, another career? How do you see that side of you?
Well, I mean, again, that was another thing that happened as a result of accident and, like, you know, being where I was and doing what I was doing. I don't play with a musical group, although that's written about me. I did play with a particular – I have performed with various collectives between here and India and the UK and all over America. But I see that – that's just an extension of like, my upbringing and how I came up. I mean, I grew up in the music scene. In the rave movement, in the hip hop movement, in the house movement, and Chicago is a deeply, deeply music oriented city. And I started going to shows when I was a kid. So that didn't seem to me like I was trying to start another career. That seemed to me as something that I did because my friends asked me to, and I was there to do it. So I put myself forward that way, but I did break dance all the way through, you know. I mean, I kept dancing my whole life, but as the style and as the music changed, I continued. I kind of made my own flows that were, you know, in the Midwest, we have our own style of movement and so much talent there, you know, it spills out the doors into the gutter. I mean, I just came up in that scene. And so we all, you know, we go to the middle of the floor and show. That's how we do. That's where awesome. I'm from. So like you put your money where your feet are. You know what I mean? So I came up in that, and so it just made sense for me to be always moving and dancing. And I love to go to the party. So like it was just an extension of that.
Yep.
So.
Now, before we go, what kinds of projects are you working on now? And, like, what can people look forward to seeing you in?
Oh, thanks for asking. I've just done a bunch of really wonderful stuff. I did this movie with Maggie Gyllenhaal this summer called The Kindergarten Teacher, which I think is really kind of moving. It's going to go to Sundance. Awesome. I was in a play in England based on the story of Bob Evans' life. You know, the kid stays in the picture. You know that, you know that documentary?
Yeah.
So we made a play of it with a director I've been working with for the last 20 years in London. His name's Simon McBurney. He's a great actor in his own right, but he's also got a great theater company called Complicité that I've been playing with. And my wife and I were in this last piece, and it's meant right now, cross fingers, to come to Broadway this year. So we're trying to think to see whether or not it's coming. We already were meant to start in January, but it got pushed. So we are we're looking at that. And I've done a couple indies, and I was just in a production of Hamlet here in town. So I'm busy, and I've got a little boy right now. So I just am like looking forward to whatever's next. I don't know what's next, but I do know that I'm having fun. So that's what's up.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you there's always cult movies and whatnot, and they're just great because they are what they are. Have you guys heard like rumblings of like people trying to get you guys to do like an Office Space 2 or a sequel?
Oh, they're always yeah. trying to do that. They're always trying to do that. There's even like, you know, companies that like, you know, like business companies, like, you know, I don't know, like DocuSign or whatever, that want to like make a sequel and stuff like that. And Mike Judge would never, ever make a sequel to that movie. Office Space is a sequel to Milton. So that's the kind of, I think that's the end of that that particular story. But and with the success of Silicon Valley, I think that it, you know, he's always trying to go forward. So I don't know.
I just wouldn't want to see it. Like, I wouldn't want to see it. It's just great and leave it alone. I feel like it just happens to so many things, and it just, ugh. You know.
Yeah, well, they did Bad Santa too, and I didn't have anything to do with it, and I never even saw it. So,
yeah, you know. Join the group.
Right.
So. Now, you've been so forthcoming and talking to us about everything that's going on, but is there ever a time where you just, like, somebody comes up to you and you're like, oh my God, I just answered 20 questions about Office Space. Please, let's talk about something else.
Well, no, I mean, like, look, I there was a time when I would when it was kind of like, hey, you don't mind if I go, do you? But I mean, like, I just let them spit, because I mean, if they need to say it, so they have so if it's inconvenient, I just like I just kind of say, hey, you know, I kind of got to go, or like, I'm just having dinner with my wife and or whatever, or I'm just chilling. So I'm so glad you enjoyed the movie. Yeah. You know what I mean? And that, right. I mean, there are people that are fanatic about it, and that's cool. I mean, like I mean, my wife worked with William Shatner, you know, and he, like, you know, there's Trekkies all around, you know, Trekkies would really be after him and stuff like that. So he would like whatever woman he was with, he would like pretend to make out with them to like get to, like, cause the people get really embarrassed. You know what I mean? So my wife calls it pulling a Shatner. So, like, you know, if I really need to, I can always just pull a Shatner.
No, Shatner never tried to make out with your wife, right?
Oh, I think he did. No. So, I mean, I think that's where we got the idea.
That's kind of cool, too.
Yeah, yeah. That's a story for grandkids.
It's cool.
Ajay, I want to thank you so much for giving us the time. And
you guys, great interview. Thanks so much. Awesome. It's been great talking. Thank you.
So, yes. If people want to check you out and say hi or say they heard you on this, where can they go?
Oh, They can go to, I'm sorry to be nerd, but they can go to Facebook or whatever. Yeah. Say, sorry. Would you please send me a link?
100%.
Comes up. Thanks, guys. Absolutely. I really look forward to it.
Absolutely.
And great show, guys. By the way.
Thank you.
Great.
Perfect, awesome. Man. Thank you. Thank you so much, man. I had a lot of
Thanks,
fun.
Guys.
Thank you.
Absolute pleasure,
Thank
sir.
You. Take it easy. Thank Take you care. So much, guys. All right. Bye.
Nice guy.
Very nice guy.
Yeah. You know. If you move to Louisiana, I might have to have him come in and replace you.
Oh,
Scott
okay.
and Ajay doing a show. Scott and Ajay.
You go wild. Here you and go. Somebody's like, hey, it's a guy, and he starts making out with you, you know, just to keep the paparazzi away.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, pretty cool. Mm-hmm. It's cool to like. Yeah, like I love these guys. They get this one character you remember, but you look at their like resume and they're like Broadway and this and that, and you're like, you think of the side character like, oh, that was their one thing they ever did. They did like hundreds of things, you know.
Well, I just love how he talked about like he made that one movie Ashes, and he was so truthful. It's like, it takes too long. I tell people, don't do it.
Well, I mean, even like our friend Dom, you know, he put that movie out, and like he just put a book out on like what he learned from making. Shout out to you, Dom. Making movies, and you hear these directors that they pour their life savings into making short films, and it's always that balance: is it worth it? And I always tend to be on the side of it's worth it, like because
it's always
you might
hard
never to, do it again.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it's always going to be it's. The struggle while it's occurring, and then you have to factor in balancing family and then
financial
other stuff,
yep.
And yeah, and just all the small things you wouldn't think of, maybe like catering or something like that, where you're like, Jesus Christ, yeah. I just want to put my thought out there onto film.
Yeah, it's hard to put yourself behind the eight ball or in debt, like, you know, major debt for like your selfish project at the same time, mm-hmm. You know, like, yes, I want to do it and I want to show people, but do I work the next 10 years to get out from underneath the movie I just put out or whatnot.
Well, I will finance Lake Patrol. I'm just putting it out there right now.
All right. You heard it here.
I'm going to Bank of America tomorrow and be like, you're giving me that money.
All right, let's take a quick break. All right, Ajay Naidu. Awesome.
Great interview.
I really enjoyed it. You know, like we say it all the time when like we make fun of the interviews a couple weeks after the ones that we don't like. But like we were just looking back in November. I even put a post up on our Instagram. If you follow us at Verbal Shenanigans on Instagram, but I was looking through the November page and I'm like, damn, like that was one hell of a November. Like Trent Dilfer, Mo Vaughn. The guy from The Onion, Scott Dickers.
Yeah, the Jersey Devils anthem singer.
Arlette, she was great.
Aisha Ashe. Jonathan Lee Iverson.
Right, the ringmaster. This is a really sick month of the podcast. Even like October, too, where you go back into Dilfer. And I don't know. Like, it was just a very effective couple months. So hopefully we're able to keep that up for you guys.
But, yeah, definitely.
Crazy guess. But Berlo, with that sentiment, I think it's time to bring back a segment we have not done in a long, long time.
I can't even remember the last time we did it.
I have no idea. It's got to be
at least 4, 5, 6 months.
Yeah, at least. Well, we're going to bring a Dirtbag of the Week. This is where the music comes in.
Oh, okay.
Dirtbag of the Week. All right. So for those of you who are just joining us on your first episode into the Verbal Shenanigans world here, we play a game called Dirtbag of the Week. It's our oldest segment. And it's exactly what it is. I'm going to give Berlew three stories here, and he's going to choose the dirtbag of the week and tell me why. All right.
Yes,
so,
I will.
First one. Man gets 4 years for sending strippers to neighbors. Man gets 4 years in prison for sending strippers to neighbors.
Why am I not living next to him?
I got to start getting the soundboard app. You know, like I had one too. All right. So Nebraska man, which didn't happen in Florida for once, has been sentenced to 4 years in printing.
Printing?
4 years. He's printing for 4 years.
That son of a bitch.
That's a bad punishment. 4 years in prison for sending prostitutes to strip on his neighbor's porch dozens of times over a 3 year period. The Omaha World Herald reports that the 45-year-old Douglas Goldsberry of Elkhorn, that sounds like a name from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Douglas Goldsberry of Elkhorn. Winter is coming. It was sentenced Friday in the Douglas County District Court after pleading no contest in September to pandering. Authorities say Goldsberry hired prostitutes to bare their breasts and strip in his neighbor's porch while he watched from his kitchen. The neighbors, a married couple who lived across the street from Goldsberry, said women had shown up as many as 75 times since 2013, exposing themselves and sometimes kicking the door and yelling for payment, waking up the couple's two small children. Solicitation charges against Goldsberry were dismissed as part of a plea deal under state guidelines. He will serve less than 2 years of his sentence with a credit of 177 days already spent in jail, but his legal troubles are far from over. Investigators found evidence of child pornography on his computer. He has been indicted in federal court for possession of child pornography and faces up to 20 years if convicted.
I think I'm going to have to omit the child pornography part of this story to get a proper dirtbag of the week, because that's just instantaneous.
All right.
Dirtbag
so
of the
based
week,
on what
but,
he did.
Yeah, I'm just kind of wondering that, like, family... Like, somebody showed up 75 times. So, like, around the 30th time, you think the wife is like, are you going to do something? I told you, I've been busy.
Which tells you that the dad probably likes it. Like, yeah, another package. The guys at work love me.
Some 8-year-old.
Yay, yay. My brother told me he had a secret Christmas present for me. This is interesting.
Honey, I bought something on eBay. I'll be back in an hour.
All right, so that is whatever his name, Donnie Goldberg of Elkhorn. Mm-hmm. Douglas Elkhorn. Goldsberry of Elkhorn. All right. Back to Florida, Mike.
Here we go.
Florida man purposely crashed his car to prove the intersection is unsafe.
I'm loving these people so far. Yeah. I'm not sure if we can call anybody like, dirtbag.
This sounds like he would hang out with One-Eyed Larry or whatever his name is and all your other friends.
One-Eyed Joe.
One-Eyed Joe and the pussy eyeball. Yeah.
He's eating a can of sardines watching the strippers come up to his porch.
Florida man, Bruce J. Homer, 61, was so driven to prove a busy intersection in his neighborhood unsafe that police said he purposely crashed his truck into an SUV to make a point. People are always running stop signs at this intersection, and since you guys, law enforcement, don't do anything about it, I did. No one was injured. The SUV driver told deputies he was going through the intersection in Claremont when Homer's truck pulled out in front of him, according to the Daily Commercial. The motorist said Horner then walked up to him and said, "You ran the stop sign, and this is the 10th accident at this intersection, and they won't do anything till somebody dies." He said, I ran some guy off the road after I saw him blow through the intersection, investigators said Homer told them. Homer was charged with 2 counts of aggravated battery with a deadly weapon and 1 count of reckless driving. He was released in Lake County Jail after posting his $20,000 bond.
I like how he thinks it's a cop's job to like hook up streetlights. I mean, what is he doing there? You damn guys, you're not doing your job and all. There's a pothole out there, too. Why don't you do your job?
I also like that he purposely gets in an accident. He's like, see? But he did it on purpose, just completely negating his his argument. You know, like it was an accident. Accident and on
overruled.
Accident and on purpose are literally oxymorons. Yeah. So
yeah, it doesn't work out too well.
Yeah. So that's Douglas. No, not Douglas.
Florida
Homer.
Man.
Some Florida guy. Yeah. Florida guy. Bruce. Bruce Homer. Good old Bruce. Crimes against fashion. The 44-year-old Goss was previously employed as an administrative assistant to a judge in Garland County, Arkansas. That is, until authorities accused her of fraudulently charging. Mm-hmm. How much you think she charged to this credit card? It wasn't just the dog tuxedo.
Oh, okay. No,
there was other things.
I thought you were trying to make me guess what a dog tuxedo costs.
No.
Still, I would probably say about $2,000. I will say $35,000.
She charged $200,000 to the Garland County credit card. Goss used the card to purchase a diamond bracelet, tickets to Arkansas Razorbacks football game, sequin throw pillows, and pet insurance. Oh, and an adorable tuxedo for her dog.
Mm. Well, you got to look swaggy when you go to those Razorback Auburn games.
Goss was sent to stand trial Tuesday but opted to plead guilty at a pretrial hearing Monday to 6 felony counts of fraudulent use of the county's credit. I like that the county has a credit card. Like who is in charge of that?
Well, I like how it she didn't do this all in a couple of days. So, like, somebody got the first bill. It's like, it's up $35,000.
Yep.
I'm going to be watching this to see where this goes.
So she has possibility of facing 20 years, facing between 3 and 20 years, whatever that means. That's a big difference.
Yeah.
Between 3 and 20 years for each count. All right, Burlum. Time for your decision and why. All right. You got John Homer, which is our friend from Florida, purposely crashing his car.
Mm-hmm.
You got the Nebraska man, Douglas Goldsberry of Elkhorn, who, again, sent strippers to his neighbors 75 times. Okay. And you have the woman who used the county's credit card to buy her dog a tuxedo, among other things. All right.
Yeah, this is a tough one. Like,
they always are, bro. Yeah, they always are.
Like, for the county credit card, I've actually heard a worse story. I should have brought it up. There was one guy that found out, like, his bank, there was, like, a bug in the system where when it was overdrawn, it wouldn't stop him. So he went $2 million in debt buying strippers and a bunch of stuff. And they tried to send him in jail, and then, like, I think it was in Australia, and Australia pretty much said, well, you screwed up, it's not his fault, you didn't catch it, so he's over, he'll spend the rest of his life in debt, but...
yeah.
Mm.
Well, what do you got?
But that is a county credit card.
Your tax money, Barlow, buying dog tuxedos.
Yeah, but Razorback tickets. I don't know about that.
All right.
I guess in last place, the least dirt bag, not including the child pornography thing, is my dude from Florida with the strippers.
Okay.
It defies logic and it's hilarious at the same time. So it's one of those, you're a dick, but I'm going to give you a pass on this one.
Okay.
So it's down between the credit card and the purpose accident.
All right, so you eliminated Douglas Goldberry of Elkhorn.
Yes,
right.
Yes. Be gone, you. The Red Wedding is coming.
Okay. So you have Florida Man or Razorback?
I'm going to give it to Florida Man.
Ooh, the man who crashed
purposely
his own car.
Purposely crashed. Yeah, he could have literally killed somebody just on the purpose of being right versus actually talking to somebody about this. I mean, it's one of those weird things where, like, you can't be a vigilante, for lack of a better term, and that's why I'm going to give it to him. The The Iron Woman, that's pretty scummy, but at the end of the day, again, I'll give her points for comedy on that, so... At the end of the day, it's like, alright, what's the worst thing that can happen? Well, she cost the county $200,000. The worst thing he could happen was he could have put some guy into a pole and killed him.
So this is all under the asterisk of the child porn guy. Like, if
yeah,
say,
if we right. include child porn, yeah. Number one, we can't even...
Yeah,
debate.
Yeah, there's no
that.
Debate. All right. Yeah, yeah. All right. So let's see if I get his name again. All right. Bruce John Homer, 61 years old of Florida. Once again, I think Florida might be undefeated in dirt
playing. Just with that name, you can't be surprised he did it. Yeah. Bruce John Homer.
Bruce John Homer, you are this week's dirtbag.
Dirtbag.
Of the week.
Of the week.
Oh, it's good to get that back.
Yeah.
In a long
yeah.
time. But I guess it's time to get out of here, right?
Yeah, I got a plane in the morning.
You got a plane?
Yeah.
Wow, Izzy's really treating you well.
Well, I got the county credit card, so I got certain things I need.
Well, hope it's not the same plane.
It's going to be used for aerial shots for beach patrol.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
good. Hopefully, it's not the Roy Holiday plane.
No.
Actually, I was reading up on it. The guy who designed the plane crashed in that plane.
That's
not
your first
usually...
thought to go is maybe I should look at a competitor.
Yeah, and apparently Roy Holiday, who I loved, I always wanted him. You probably all the good stuff from him. But apparently he was driving flying a little bit of a maniac.
He was literally showing off. It's that competitiveness, get the blood pumping kind of deals where it's like, oh, Roy.
Yeah.
I mean, sad he's gone, but at the same time, he's like, Roy, you kind of did it to yourself there, buddy. I'm sorry.
But sorry, Roy. Anything to promote, Berlo?
I'll prevent.
You'll prevent?
Yeah. No sponsors! I'll give a shout-out to Randy Santel, foodchallenges.com. This coming Wednesday will be one of his first videos from his tour down in Australia. He did Australia, Singapore, New Zealand for Food Challenges down there. So it was a really big tour. His videos are always fun. He was a great guest two times. He slept on Scott's floor.
He did.
Passed out. So always a shout out to our buddy Randy Santel.
Drinking margaritas out of the bladder bag. It was like a boxed margarita thing. You're just slapping.
That looks like an awesome food challenge. Eat this 5-pound burger, but then slap the bladder.
Yes, Randy is awesome. Yeah,
so youtube.com/Randy Santel or his site foodchallenges.com.
All right, and I will promote. We got a special Verbal Shenanigans comedy show coming up at Tap House 15 on the 28th of December with headliner Don Jameson from That Metal Show. So it should be pretty fun, along with a bunch of other funny comics. I want to thank AJ, and guys, listen to the podcast. Share it. Listen to the last 2 months. Go check out some of the guests we had. It's like a catalog of awesome people. So share it with your friends. Leave reviews. Interact with us. Follow us on all social media and all that fun stuff. But that's it. Life is funny. Laugh at it. We'll see you next week. Keep the wind at your back.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster.
Sung by the legendary Michael Bolton.
Damn, it feels good to be a gangster. A real gangster-ass nigga plays his cards right. A real gangster-ass nigga never runs his fucking mouth, cause real gangster-ass niggas don't start fights. And niggas always got a hot cap, showing all his boys how he shot him. Real gangsta ass niggas don't flex nuts, cause real gangsta ass niggas know they got them. And everything's cool in the mind of a gangster, cause gangsta ass niggas think deep. Up 365, ayo, 24/7, cause real gangsta ass niggas don't sleep. And all I gotta say to you, wanna be cocksucker, pussy, pranksters.